This is a Day One podcast extra, bringing you a conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One, which features outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to the Day One Podcast Extra. This is Peter Wallace, and with me today is the very Reverend Dr. Ian Markham, who last August assumed his duties as Dean and President of Virginia Theological Seminary in Alexandria, Virginia. Ian is an ordained Episcopal priest and previously was the Dean and Professor of Theology and Ethics at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut.
Entirely. Yep, that's my resume in a sentence.
Virginia Seminary, you introduced us to on the Day One program, but give us a snapshot description of the seminary.
Virginia Theological Seminary is 90 acres inside the Beltway in Northern Virginia, Alexandria, founded in 1823, 185 years old, 300 students, 25 faculty, probably the strongest seminary in the Anglican Communion.
And you've been there about a year. How has that year been for you? What are some of the changes that you've begun to institute at the seminary this past year?
There are probably three major changes that I've identified and worked with the community to develop. The first is around the whole theme of identity. Mm-hmm. Who are we as a school? And I think it's very important at this time that our witness is clear. Virginia Theological Seminary is in the broad center of the Episcopal Church. It's a school which is both orthodox and yet at the same time open. And what I mean by that is it's creedal, it's incarnational, trinitarian, it's biblical. We require all the students to learn a biblical language and to love Scripture. But at the same time, it's open. It's open to the conversation. It's open to disagreement. We have faculty, staff, and students on both sides of the debate on human sexuality. And it's also open to full inclusion of all those who wish to study there. And the reason why I think this is important is because we live in an age where many in the Anglican Communion assume that if you question human sexuality, then you inevitably question incarnation, Trinity, Orthodox Christianity, and that's not where we are. We're a creedal school which continues to affirm what the creeds teach. The second area is around the whole area of welcome and hospitality. Virginia Theological Seminary is a seminary where all the buildings form a circle. So when you drive into the campus, the first thing you do is hit the backs of buildings. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why it's like that is because it's a place which celebrates community. So we eat together, we worship together, we study together, and we form an intimate, close community. But in terms of formation, I need to make sure that our students leave the school so that they're not just good at community, but also good at welcome and hospitality. So one of the changes I will be introducing will be a welcome centre, and we will create an environment where we learn to receive guests and we learn to receive them well. And then the third important area is the whole area of the Anglican Communion. Since 1851, we have had students from the Communion studying at Virginia Theological Seminary. We have a number of primates around the Communion who are alums of the school. This is an important part of our work. This is the year of Lambeth. And my prayer is that insofar as things get difficult between different provinces at the level of general conventions and primates, the connections between the Episcopal Church and the rest of the Communion will be found through diocese, through our alums, in theological education, through strategic partnerships. So I've moved Barney Hawkins in as the first executive director of the Center for Anglican Communion Studies.
Virginia Seminary also maintains an outreach to the laity. How is that goal being accomplished?
Yes, we take enormous pride in the fact that we not only train people for ordained ministry, we also train lay people through the Masters of Theological Studies, and that's also a residential program. In addition, we have an Institute for Christian Formation and Leadership, which really tries to provide theological education from the cradle to the grave. And part of that work is work with children in the Centre for the Ministry of Teaching, but also in a whole host of programmes for laity, including the Lay School of Theology, Fridays at the Seminary, a variety of programmes where anybody who's interested in being shaped, learning, being formed to think deeper about their faith can participate. And it deals with everything from why Richard Dawkins is wrong through the issues around religion and culture.
Well, what can we expect to see from Virginia Seminary in the next 5 to 10 years?
Virginia Theological Seminary has, I think, a particular obligation at this time. Things are difficult in some of the seminaries in the Episcopal Church. There is some anxiety around survival. We're not in that place. So the question then is, well, what should we as a school be doing given that we're not worrying about survival? And given our traditions up against it, and given that connections with the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion are difficult, and given that it would be good to have a tradition which is getting larger rather than smaller, there are a number of challenges we face. And so over the next 5 to 10 years, my goal is to enable our students to face those challenges, to have the resources to think through those challenges, and to create leaders of congregations which really makes a difference, both in terms of our connections across the communion and also to the vital and healthy nature of the congregations they end up leading.
Much of your academic career has focused on the issue of Christian ethics. You teach theology and ethics at Virginia Seminary. You've earned degrees in ethics. And among the numerous books and articles you've written is a recent book, Do Morals Matter? A Guide to Contemporary Religious Ethics. First of all, how would you define the terms morals and ethics?
Often they're synonyms. But I do distinguish between the term ethics describes systems. So, for example, natural law is an ethical system, while morals tends to be more applied. What should we be doing in this or that situation?
Well, I notice you describe this book as a guide to contemporary religious ethics. Does that mean ethics have changed or evolved over time? In other words, what makes them contemporary?
Oh, the issues primarily. I think the basic approach to ethics doesn't need to change, but the issues are constantly changing. So, for example, the issue of stem cell research or the possibilities in medical ethics generally, the question of preemptive war, the issue of polyamory, which is dividing the Unitarian Universalists. These are questions which are new and modern and recent. And therefore, the purpose of the book was to try and write a contemporary, up-to-date ethical map, given the vast changes that are constantly occurring in the ethical arena.
So if you have a system of ethics, it really doesn't matter what issue arises. Is that correct?
I think Christian ethics basically is still the same, which is that it's committed to creating virtuous people transformed by the gospel to live lives which are focused on God and on what God requires. So that's the core system. And how do we know what's right and wrong? We do so by reflecting on scripture, in conversation with society, learning from the experiences of others. But the questions are new and dramatically new. And there are real difficult issues for us to think through, especially around the environment and political and social order.
Do you find that ethical systems cross various world religious and geographical boundaries today well, or are there vast differences among the systems? And if so, how do we bridge the gap or the gulf between those?
Ethical systems are complicated. They overlap at certain points. They diverge at different points. Within a given tradition, there are a variety of different approaches, even if they share the same sources. So the truth about it is like an interlocking matrix, really. There are certain approaches to ethics that I find very congenial in other faith traditions. There are others which are very contrasting. And what one needs to do is one needs to spend time understanding exactly how the system works within the other tradition. I'm very taken with John Donne's expression where he talked about crossing over and coming back. Mm. When you're involved in interreligious dialogue, the secret is that you go into their worldview, you seek to understand it from the inside, and then you return and you work out what you've learned and in what ways you've been affected and shaped and where the commonalities are and where the differences are. And there are differences which are important to recognize and confront.
I understand you're working on a new book, Confronting the New Atheists.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, there's a trinity of atheists which are nestled in the New York Times bestseller list for months on end. Mm-hmm. Richard Dawkins, an Englishman, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris. And there's been a number of people who've written about their work. I'm eager to go into conversation with them for several reasons. The first is that they are actually getting significant attention. Mm. And I think that certainly the blue states, those who read The Da Vinci Code, are also reading Dawkins, Hitchens, and Harris. And I feel that it's important that silence is not taken to indicate that we don't have a response to these writings. I think the second reason is because the conversation can be illuminating. As you work out what problems they have with faith, so you clarify precisely what we want to claim about the nature of God and God's relations with the world. And therefore, engaging with the new atheists is a good way of actually learning to think coherently and clearly about what we mean by prayer, about what we're believing about the origins of the world, about exactly what evidence we have for faith. Come to that, what exactly we mean by the word faith. And yes, I'm working on that project now.
And you're obviously a very busy person with a lot of responsibility on your plate. How do you enjoy downtime? How do you cultivate your own spiritual relationship?
I think one of the most important parts of my life is hanging out with my wife, Leslie, and my son, Luke. They're both enormously precious. And if I had to describe my primary identity, I would say first and foremost a Christian and a priest, but then second a husband and a father. And then third, I happen to write books and be dean of a school. Mm. And that hierarchy is really important to me. And it's certainly in the company of my wife and son that I actually do find myself being renewed and refreshed. And I encounter anew the grace of God in all sorts of ways. And of course, the joy of faith is in all those moments when one just finds one smiling in the company of somebody you love, perhaps sharing a meal or strolling around the yard and looking at flowers and grass and birds and the air and all those precious moments, one finds oneself refreshed and renewed and equipped and ready to serve God afresh on a new day.
Ian Markham, thank you for visiting with us.
I'm delighted to be here.